and you have got lost. But they adhere to laws outside the laws as laid down by those we don't subscribe to. The world is getting stranger.
That was Revolution from Chrissy Hynde and the Pretenders. Just a tremendous song. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. People know, if you've listened to the show in the past couple of weeks, I've been really outraged by all the concentrated assault against women that was up in the Super Bowl this year. And I had a show that focused on that last week. But I also have started to think about, we need to keep pounding at this. It's such an important question. So a few days ago, someone hipped me to a presentation called Abortion, Morality, and the Liberation of Women. And it featured Dr. Susan Wicklund, who's the author of This Common Secret, My Journey as an Abortion Provider, and Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution newspaper. And I wanted to bring that to you this week. So the entire show, we're going to spend listening to this presentation. So without any further ado, let's jump right into it.
We are very, very excited about this program, Abortion, Morality, and the Liberation of Women. Just the title alone is really an issue of our time. And not only of this time, but it speaks to the heart of what kind of world we would want to live in and what kind of world we at Revolution Book are endeavoring and working to bring into being. I'm going to introduce first Susan Wicklund, who has worked in the field of reproductive health for 20 years. She currently has a clinic in Montana. People come from states all around, from as far away as 12 different states, come and utilize this clinic. And I was mentioning to her before this that this afternoon I was in Revolution Books, and I said, well, let me take another look at this book, Susan Wicklund, This Common Secret. And I have to confess, I got to the first chapter about her flower grandma, and I got all teared up. I said, well, my God, why? What is this all about? And she describes a story in there of going to tell her grandmother what she's about to see on 60 Minutes, where Dr. Wicklund was about to appear, telling what she does for a living. And I won't spoil the story, but a story emerges from her grandmother of what the world was like before there was the right to abortion.
Thank you. It's always overwhelming to see that, and I don't feel any different than any one of you who just does what you do every day. And that's the honest to God truth. I love what I do. And that may sound very strange to many people, but I work in an area of medicine. I work in an area of medicine where I am privileged to be with women through one of the most important passages in their life. One of the few times when they actually can take control of what they're doing. When they're not doing something because somebody else tells them they have to or because they're forced to, but because they have made the choice within themselves. And there are many women that, yes, of course, we feel sadness sometimes. Women are in a very tough situation, but most of the women who leave the clinic leave feeling stronger because they have made a choice about their lives. It's been a conscious choice on whether or not they're ready to be a parent at that time in their lives. So thank all of you for the many things that you do as well. We each have our role, and I don't want to ever, ever assume that my role is any better or any different than anyone else's. We each do what is important to us. So thank all of you as well. And thanks to Deborah for getting me out here, and Sansara. I've known Deborah for a long time, and we traveled from different parts of the country to go to Dr. Tiller's funeral, and Deborah and Sansara and Lori and I sat in a hotel room and talked about what next, and they came up with the idea of doing a tour around the country to try to get people to speak out and actually say the word abortion out loud.
Abortion!
God! Oh. It is not something shameful or bad, nothing we should feel guilty about. And how would that look to do a tour? I have just started a new clinic in Livingston, Montana. It's been open 6 months, and it's a wonderful clinic, and I just can't take a chunk of time to travel around the country and do the speaking that I would like to do. I don't have the financial resources, and I don't have another person to take care of the clinic while I'm gone. I've done a fair amount of speaking, and yes, I have used my voice a lot to talk about abortion rights, to talk about what I do, to talk about about who the women are, and of course it's everyone. Any woman of childbearing age that's sexually active has a chance of finding herself with an unintended pregnancy. So there is no stereotype. It doesn't matter what age they are, what race they are, what socioeconomic background, it affects every woman. It can affect any woman in this country. So the first question that I want to answer for you is, why did I start providing abortions? And for those of you who may have read my book, This Common Secret, the answers are in there, at least part of the answers. And it has to do with my own history. And I think any one of us moves forward in life based on what our own history is and what's happened to us. I had a horrendous abortion when I was in my early 20s by a physician who didn't explain anything to me and told me to basically shut up and lie still. No one cared. No one was compassionate. No one talked to me. No one said, if it hurts, let us know and we'll stop and fix it. And I got scared. I was very young, had not started college yet. You know, I'd been living in San Francisco and was having a high old time. Anyway, they told me to shut up and lie still and literally held me down while they did the abortion. And I found myself then injected with something that put me out. And when I woke up, I was naked on a naugahyde couch in a locked room. A horrendous experience. I have never regretted that I made that choice. Never regretted having had that abortion. I am very sad I ended up in the facility that I did. And as my life moved forward, I eventually had a child, was married for a short time, and when at the age of 26, was living in a tent in a goat pasture in northern Wisconsin, literally, I'm not kidding you. We fenced the cattle, or the goats, and the pigs, and the ducks and chickens out, and fenced the people in on a 40-acre lot of land. And I decided I wanted to be a doctor. And my family was rural Wisconsin, poor family, and I didn't even dare tell them when I first started college that I wanted to be a doctor, because how dare I have the audacity to think I could be a physician. But I made it through undergrad and med school as a single mom, and then was determined to learn to do abortions because I wanted to do that as part of the care of my own patients. And I wanted to do it with dignity and with respect and carefully and do it the right way. And ended up going to a program where I learned how to provide abortions, went back to my hometown in northern Wisconsin to provide them along with the rest of my care, and was promptly told by the doctor, or by the hospital board rather, where I was going to be practicing, that I could not. They forbid me from doing abortions. There's a lot more to that story that's in the book, and I'm not going to go through all of it. But the bottom line is I ended up with my mother. I had a wonderful mother who was feminist before we knew the word, in our community at least, and she encouraged me and to take my daughter to go to a march in D.C. in 89. And at that march, I was already providing abortions to my own patients, even though the hospital board didn't know it. But went to that march in 89, yeah. Having to work underground in 1989 was terrible, but I did it. And heard Molly Yard speak and say, there are those of you out there who have other skills you're not using. You need to do what you can do for the causes you believe most in. So I went back to the Midwest, called a few clinics to find out if they needed any help providing abortions, and was within the next year, I was working in 5 clinics in 3 states. Every day I was in an airplane flying to either Milwaukee, Wisconsin, Appleton, Wisconsin, Duluth, Minnesota, Fargo, North Dakota, and then Minneapolis, St. Paul, and traveled constantly, but was not yet speaking, was not talking about it, and in fact didn't even tell my family, except for my mother and my daughter, of course, that I was providing abortions. And the antis figured it out. You know, this woman that was going in the clinic every week wasn't a patient going in every week for an abortion, but they had only had male doctors at some of these clinics. So, you know, I must be a new nurse that was working there or something else, or a new office person, and finally figured out that I was the physician. And the lambs of God eventually made their way to our home in northern Minnesota and barricaded themselves around the house, cement barrels. Again, to tell you the whole story, is it just goes on and on and on. It was unbelievable what they were doing to us as a family. And the day that they had put cement barrels in the yard and to try to keep me from going to the clinic, which is the same day that I snuck out of the house carrying a loaded .45, which is the same day I drove, you know, all night long to get to the clinic in Fargo, and then that morning showed up at the clinic, and the protesters, of course, thought I was barricaded in my house because their buddies, 260 miles away, of course, were holding me captive, and they were quite shocked when, for the first time ever, I stepped out of that clinic with my scrubs on and my lab coat, and I put my fist in the air, and I said, yes, there will be clinic today. You are not going to stop this clinic. It was the day that I dug in my heels, and my daughter will say to people now, don't ever tell my mother she cannot do something, because it doesn't matter what it is, that is what she will promptly move forward to do. And that's what happened. And that was the same day that they then left the house and went to my daughter's school and went around to all the different students in school as the school administration was trying to get them out of there. There was many of them telling Sonia's mother kills babies and putting up wanted posters with my face on it saying wanted for the murder of children. And of course, then the school principal principal calls, and he's hysterical, and my daughter's almost hysterical. She was calmer than he was, quite frankly. At the same time, 60 Minutes was on the phone to the clinic director wanting to know if there was any physician there that was willing to publicly talk about what was going on at the clinics. And she was telling the 60 Minutes people, no, there's nobody here that'll talk to you. And I'm saying, who's that? Yes, we need to talk to them. And so out of that became my movement forward, and found that the more I speak about abortion rights, the better it is for all of us, not just for the patients, not just for you, not just for the country, but for us as providers and for me personally. I really feel it's important for me to speak out, and I'm at this point in my life trying to do whatever I can to help people find their voice. And that was one of the reasons for writing the book, This Common Secret. When that 60 Minutes episode was going to air, I had to go tell my grandmother, because she never, ever mixed 60 Minutes. She and her best friend Edith would get one beer of the week, and their big bowl of popcorn, and sit down on Sunday night to watch 60 Minutes, and they always watched it. And I didn't know if Grandma knew. In fact, I was sure Grandma didn't know that I was providing abortions. So I went to tell her the day before it aired, and I was terrified. I was terrified because I did not know what she was going to say or think. And I ended up sitting in her trailer house with Grandma sitting me down and holding my hand and patting on my hand over and over. And she started staring at the wall. She wouldn't look at me. She had tears running down her face, but she could not look at me. And she talked about being 16 years old and helping her best friend who had gotten pregnant, and they believe it was incest, helping her best friend end a pregnancy, because in those days it was very disastrous. And my grandmother and her sister, Violet, put something sharp up there, is how my grandmother described it. And then she described how the girl started bleeding, and how the blood wouldn't stop, and how they started packing her vagina with rags, and how they sat in the bed with her as she bled to death. So Grandma was patting my hand, and she finally turned to look at me, and she said, I know what you do, and I'm so proud of you. I'm glad you're doing abortion safe so that people don't kill their best friends like I did. Can you imagine? Every day when I go to work, I think about my grandma, and I think about the abortion I had and how I was treated. And I am so determined that women who come to my clinic are treated with respect, that they understand what's going on, that their questions are answered, that my staff is as on top of it as they can possibly be for each and every patient. We do not do patients en masse at my clinic. Patients come in one at a time. And when they walk in the door, they have all of our undivided attention until they're out the door and the next patient comes. So it's a very different model than what you'll see at some of the larger clinics. It's the way I work. It's the only way that I'm willing to work in providing abortions. Women have a harder time now obtaining an abortion, legal abortion, in the United States than they did 20 years ago. And there's more shame and guilt associated. Women walk in the clinic and they say, oh, I feel so bad, and this is such a terrible thing to do, and I don't want to kill my baby, but I've got two kids at home, or I don't want to be a mother, or whatever they decide. We've talked about, where does this come from? Why? Where does this rhetoric come from that has been weighted upon their shoulder? The Catholic Church and others have spent millions and millions of dollars to make us feel shameful, to silence us, to silence the abortion providers, to threaten us in any way that they possibly can. You know, for God's sake, you can't get much more serious than killing doctors, bombing clinics. They now come out in front of the clinics with posters with the sights, you know, the crosshairs, and abortion providers' face in it, and says, you're next. And stand in front of the clinics, and they get away with it. And so the patients come in with a whole different feeling than they did 20 years ago. And I think that one of the things that we as a society, we as people who are supportive, can do is just start talking about abortion and not make it this big silent secret. Anything that's a secret is perceived as being shameful or bad. And it is not shameful and bad for a woman to take control of her reproductive life. It is a very responsible thing to do. Thank you. We have to get the dialogue as loud as we can, in as many places as we can. If they even talk about, well, as they've talked about taking our rights away, and they are taking our rights away, 24-hour waiting periods, the parental notification laws, the trap laws against the clinics, to regulate the clinics in such a way that forces them to close down, they can't afford to stay open anymore. Why are we not on the streets? Why are we not on the streets protesting and angry? I mean, we need to do whatever we can to make sure that women feel empowered, that they have the right to be able to access all reproductive health care. I'm not talking about just abortion. Birth control in Montana. Okay, now I'm going to tell you a little bit about Montana. You guys here in New York have how many clinics and how close of a distance? If you want to get an abortion, it might be a little bit of an inconvenience to have to wait 2 days to get an appointment. I really don't know. But I know it's people here, many of you here don't really understand what's happening in the heart of the country. In all of Montana, there is one clinic in Helena, Montana that is open twice a month. They charge $1,000 for a first trimester abortion. Because they can. There is another clinic in Billings, Montana that is open a couple days a week, some weeks. It's often scheduled out, you know, 2 or 3 weeks in advance, and it's the same price. That's towards the eastern part of the state. In the western part of the state, there's a clinic in Missoula, Montana, a wonderful clinic. It's a nonprofit clinic, but it also, you know, is sometimes booked out in advance, and they will work with patients on payment. And then Susan Cahill is a woman who has a clinic in Kalispell, Montana, also an excellent facility, and she works with women. And then I'm in the middle of all of that. So it's 200 miles that way to get to a clinic or 300 miles that way to get to a clinic. And I have patients because I'm willing to see patients just about any day of the week. And I have seen patients even on Sundays. Depending on what they need, I will see patients when they need to come in. But I have patients that come from 5, 6 states and Canada to see me. Distance that women have to travel to be able to obtain an abortion is unbelievable. There are no physicians openly doing abortions in all of the state of Wyoming. In all of North Dakota, which these are all huge states, you guys. I mean, they could swallow up a lot of you out here. In all of North Dakota, there is one clinic. It is on the very eastern border. In all of South Dakota, there is one clinic. It's on the very eastern border. And so you've got a woman who's a single mom, and got two kids. She's got a job, but if she misses 2 days in a row, she's going to lose her job. And in these times, maybe she doesn't even have a job. But in order to find the funds, the time, the transportation, the money for gas, a car that works, and get that distance is a huge burden for many, many people. And then trying to find doctors that'll work and stay working in the threat of being murdered. When I did the 60 Minutes piece, Leslie Stahl had said to me, "What ends do you think they will go?" And I said, "Well, I can't imagine they would ever kill anyone." And a year later, Dr. Gunn was murdered. And then again, and then another one, and then another one, and then the bombing. And of course, there was a long stretch in there, and now Dr. Tiller has been murdered, and some of the leaders of the anti-abortion movement, and I refuse to call them pro-life. Refuse to call them pro-life. But they are not. It's a little frightening to think that those are the people with those beliefs that have so much power right now, have so much power and are putting out the rhetoric, are saying the words that are so damaging to women, so damaging to their psyche, so damaging to what's in their hearts. Because as Dr. Tiller would say too, you have to trust women. And until you understand the heart of a woman, you don't understand abortion. And I think that is so true. It's your obligation to speak about abortion, to speak about, even if it's 3 people in your life, you have to tell somebody, you have to talk to somebody so they understand that you are also a woman who has chosen to take control of her life, chosen what you want to do about motherhood at this point in your life. Because if you don't, it'll only become more oppressive. People will continue to say these things that weigh us down. And each woman who walks out the door needs to speak, and every man with his wife or girlfriend or partner needs to also speak about what it has meant to them in their life and what an important part it is, a part of their health care, that they can choose this. And so it's a challenge that I'm giving the women who are walking out the door. Many, 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 many women that have abortions have no idea what it would be like if abortion was illegal. They don't know what it was like for my grandmother, and for some people in this room, what it was like and what it would be like again if abortion was illegal. But the reality is, unless you have physicians willing to do abortions, it doesn't matter if it's legal or not. If you don't have clinics whose doors are open, it doesn't matter if it's legal or not. And unless you have people who are willing to defend the clinics, it doesn't matter if it's legal or not. All I know is what affects the woman who walks in my door. And there can be bills that are passed to protect the clinic. There can be bills that are passed for this or this or this or this. But how does it affect the woman who walks in the door of my clinic? What does it mean to her? And what does it mean to her if I do something like this? And I'm hoping something like this is going to help on the larger scale and that it will make a difference for women. But I don't know. There was a year ago that I didn't have much hope at all. But the more I see these kind of events and talk with people who are actively working in the movement, the more optimism I have.
Well, I think Dr. Wicklund is following her advice, as should all of you. It's your obligation to speak out. And our next speaker, Sansara Taylor, not only speaks out, but is a courageous fighter for the liberation of women and the emancipation of humanity.
This has not been said the way it needs to be said. Dr. Tiller was a hero on the side of the people fighting for the rights of women in this country and all over the planet. Without the right to abortion, without the right for women to decide for themselves, without shame, without stigma, without restriction, when and whether they will have a child, women had no more freedom than a slave. And if women are not free, that is half of humanity, then no one is free. And if there are no doctors, as she just said, to provide this service, there is no abortion rights for women. But instead of living in a society that celebrates somebody like Dr. Tiller as the hero that he is and was, we live in a society where he's assassinated, and where in the follow-up, the media is busy calling him, on the one hand, Tiller the baby killer, and on the other hand, in the mainstream liberal media, as the New York Times did, they're portraying him as a shrewd businessman. They talk about how controversial a doctor he was because he did third trimester abortions. They actually had the nerve to debate in this article last week whether his assassination would be better for the pro-choice movement or better for the anti-abortion movement. Excuse me? He was one of three doctors in the country who was providing a procedure, late-term abortions, that ought to be available in every hospital in the country. Even in pro-choice New York, as well as women all over the world, there was a need for people who needed late-term abortions to fly down and be referred to Dr. Tiller's clinic. And he coached doctors all over the country on how to do late-term abortions in their own clinics. There is nothing shrewd about this. He risked his life to do this. He was harassed. He was blockaded. He was shot already twice in both arms. He went back to work the next day. There was no shrewd businessman there. There was nothing controversial about this man. He really was a hero of women everywhere. And his murder was a calculated political assassination that capped off decades of extra-legal and legal assault on him by people who hated him because they hate the whole notion of women being full human beings. And before I go any further, I just want everybody in the room to really take a moment and consider the responsibility that is on us to move forward from tonight and be a part of changing the dynamic in this country and fighting for a world and a society where women A, have the right to a birth control and abortion, and B, where the doctors who provide these services are celebrated and protected, not isolated, harassed, and murdered. But it was only when class society emerged, with the development of agriculture, domestication of animals, and the need to pass on wealth to one section of people and not to others, that women sexuality and women themselves had to be tightly controlled and turned into the property of men. But with this emergence of class society and patriarchy came the whole idea that women's most essential role was not as human beings, but as breeders of children, and that they were mothers before all else, or else sex objects, sort of the virgin and the whore. It first emerged, and actually in very many ways, that's still the standards that are with us today. They're in different forms, perhaps, and you can see them, they're very much in the same form when you go to the clinic doors and you see the Christian fascists there, but they're in other updated forms, but it's still with us today, this dominant message that you can be many things now in the so-called liberated world. A woman can be the commander-in-chief, the woman can aspire as high as anybody else, but you'll never do anything more meaningful than be a mother, right? I mean, if you go to the White House website, whitehouse.gov, and you look up Michelle Obama's bio, it lists all her accomplishments as a lawyer, as all the degrees, all these other things, and then it says, but if you ask Michelle Obama who she is, she will not hesitate to tell you, first and foremost, she is Sasha and Malia's mother. And besides everything that's wrong with the kinds of accomplishments she had, which we could talk about, that notion that women's most defining role is to be bearers of children is still with us. And it's rooted in the past. And this is where the opposition to women controlling their reproduction comes. It doesn't come from the fact that there's something wrong with killing a fetus. It's not a human being. It's about subordination of women. Some say we can all agree that abortion is a tragedy. And this too is dead wrong. Most women feel relief when they get abortions. They don't feel guilty or regretful. And further, given the fact that, once again, and this is really important that we keep hammering at this, given the fact that fetuses are not babies and abortion is not murder, the only thing you could possibly find tragic about abortion is that it enables women to step out of their place as breeders and servants of men. What common ground could there be with that? And to the degree that some women do feel guilty, this doesn't prove that abortion is a morally complex issue any more than the fact that many women feel guilty after being raped proves that rape is a morally complex issue. It's time for people who are sick of seeing our doctors and our heroes isolated and murdered, to engage seriously with the notion of real revolution, to liberate women and emancipate humanity as a whole, and for those who are ready to do so to get down with this revolution and begin fighting for a whole new world. And even if you're not ready for that, it's time for all of us to re-seize the moral high ground and to go on the political offensive to fight for a society where women have abortion on demand and without apology, and where the doctors who provide them are celebrated and defended. Thank you.
That was Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper. And our program today is a broadcast of a presentation on abortion morality and the liberation of women featuring Dr. Susan Wicklund, the author of This Common Secret, My Journey as an Abortion Provider, and Sansara Taylor. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. We're going to take a short break and be right back.
A brighter tomorrow, happiness and no more sorrow. Everybody's gonna love one another, just spread love and we live like brothers. When I build my world, take my word, you won't have to scream to be heard. When I build my world.
All right, that was When I Build My World by Jimmy Lewis from his album Give the Poor Man a Break. We're going to rejoin our broadcast of the presentation on abortion, morality, and the liberation of women. When this presentation was recorded, they were not able to record the questions from the audience. So I'm going to state the questions and go back to the presentation for the responses from Dr. Wicklund and Sansara. First question, why doesn't the pro-choice movement use the argument that a woman who aborts her own fetus isn't hurting anyone else in society, and therefore abortion is not murder? Sansara Taylor responds first.
There's a lot of things that don't make sense about the movement to end abortion if you take them on their face, that they're against murder, they're for preserving life. It doesn't make sense. Most of them are for the death penalty. Most of them are for the war in Iraq. Most of them, I mean, if you look at the core of the movement driving this, the Christian fascist movement at its core were the most hysterically fanatical supporters of the torture that was carried out under Bush and is continuing to be carried out under Obama. You could point out that's hypocritical on its face, but that has not stopped them, and it allows them and what they really are to be obscured from the people who could stop them, which is the majority of people in this country, women and men who care about women's lives. And that's part of why I went so into the history. The movement, the biblical scripture, what's it rooted in, why do they keep using it, and what is their vision of a society, is they use the words life, and they use the notion of being compassionate about babies, and they use the notion of caring about women. They say abortion hurts women, all these things. And they've confused a lot of people. But at its core, this has never been about that. They use those things, but at their core, they really are about subjugating women. They're really about turning women into breeders, baby-making machines, and that's it. Stay in your place. Obey your husband. These are the people who introduced the, the covenant marriages where a woman can't get a divorce. Huckabee got one of these marriages. You know, these are people who, they don't want women to be allowed to get a divorce, even if they're being abused or mangled in other ways in the confines of their marriage. If we don't start exposing that about this movement, this is part of the problem. You have a lot of people who say, well, I think abortion should be legal, but I would never get one myself, or maybe there's something wrong with it. If we don't start saying, no, actually, the science of the matter is fetuses are not babies, and that's the truth, and so it's really, are you for the subjugation of women, or are you for women being fully human? If we don't shift those terms, if all we do is point out the hypocrisy of those who claim pro-life, and we don't start revealing what this battle is really about, we will be demobilizing the people, the women and the men who need to be fighting for this. And that's where I really think we have to start holding these people to being Christian fascist, dark ages morality that they're trying to enforce, and peeling away other people who are being confused by that.
And now, Dr. Susan Wicklund.
There's also a real reluctance on the part, unfortunately, of many of the larger organizations, Planned Parenthood being one of them, to not actually use the language, to not say the word abortion. They beat around the bush and they say other things, women's reproductive rights, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da, but they don't actually get to the core of it. And I asked one leader of one of the organizations, when you do the fundraising stuff, why isn't the word abortion in this whole thing? And she said, well, we don't like to use that word because some of our fundraisers don't like the word abortion. It's like, good God, we have to be able to say it and to talk about it. And so when, you know, some of the larger organizations, and by the way, this is just my own little thing, I have to say this. You know, there's brands put on everything. You know, there's this group has its own name and is branded as the experts in this area or this area or that area. And everybody, not everybody, many people in this country think of abortion, they think of Planned Parenthood, or they think of contraception and they think of Planned Parenthood. Planned Parenthood does a minute number of the abortions in this country. It is independent providers like myself who are on the front lines, who are doing 80% of the abortions in this country. It is not Planned Parenthood.
Next question. What can the pro-choice movement do in response to clinic protests by anti-choice groups such as Operation Rescue? Dr. Wicklund responds first.
I cannot tell you how much it means to get a letter in the mail, and it doesn't matter if it's from someone I have never met, but a letter that says, thank you for being there. I'm really glad you're doing what you're doing. If there's something I can do, here's my phone number. And, you know, I rarely would call that phone number, but just to know that there are people out there, for every one letter that I get from some stranger out in Left Horseshoe, North Dakota, I know there's probably 10,000 others who actually feel that way but haven't written a letter, and it means so much. There's also going to be, I'm sure, if Operation Rescue is going to be doing this, there's going to be a need for bodies, for people to be there showing their faces in support of Dr. Carhart in whatever form that takes. And it costs a lot. The clinic defense, putting in cameras, taking care of staff, keeping people safe costs a lot. And we are not wealthy physicians. If I wanted to make a lot of money in medicine, I would not be providing abortions.
And now, Sansara Taylor.
The doctors go through things that most human beings in this country would never consider going through. And they do it because they understand some things about how essential abortion is to women's lives that most people don't understand. So I want to kind of answer this question on a couple of levels. One is, it does matter tremendously. If Operation Rescue is doing a siege or a blockade, people should be there. And they should be there physically with the doctors, with the clinic. They say, no, you're not coming through this. Mm-hmm. And it matters. It really makes a big difference. And I remember when we used to do a lot more clinic defense, they did these studies about if the first response is very robust and people come out, several things happen. People learn a lot being out there. They actually learn a lot about who is this movement to end abortion. A lot of the things that I've been talking about what they're really motivated by, mm-hmm. they get an education out there, and then they start talking about it, bring other people, be there, and it sends a message. It actually does set different terms. That's one thing. And the other thing is, I do feel on another level that this is not going to change, this dynamic, if there's not a whole... Look, there's been a cultural shift on this question for a generation. It's just been a relentless assault, and now you sort of have this thing where you can't blink, and now there's 16 and Pregnant on MTV, and there's Juno, and there's Knocked Up, and there's like all this other garbage. And the idea of abortion, it's like, it's totally written off. The idea of abortion, and further, the idea that people, that women are fully human. These are notions that are just not on the radar right now.
Dr. Wicklund with additional comments.
I just had this image of 10,000 women showing up, walking down the street, every one of them saying, I've had an abortion. If you're calling him a killer, you have to call me a killer. And I am your mother, your daughter, your bank teller, your grocery store clerk, your teacher. I am every woman. And if you call him a killer, you have to call me a killer. And can the politicians, can the general public do that?
The next question asked was, what has happened since the death of Dr. Tiller? Susan Wicklund responds first.
Well, first of all, since Dr. Tiller's death, there's been a great increase in the amount of violence and rhetoric and hate in front of the clinics. It's been very, very frightening for many providers. I'm part of the Abortion Care Network, and we email each other, have a talk network, that we're always talking about what's going on other places. And there are providers who have, right after Dr. Tiller's death, where protesters would come up to them as they're coming in to go to work and say, how do you want it? Do you want a knife or do you want a bullet? Other clinics where they're outside now with, I think I already mentioned this, with a poster with a crosshairs in it with an abortion provider's face in it and saying, who's next or you're next or whatever it might be. And they're being very emboldened by what happened with Dr. Tiller's death and the lack of outcry about it. At my clinic in our little town, 2 days after Dr. Tiller was murdered, there was two new billboards that went up that said, life, what a beautiful choice. And it's just appalling. And now they've gotten 10, it might be 12 new placards that are 5 foot high that they mount on the side walk down a row, down one of the main drives through town, of all the aborted fetuses and the gruesome parts. You know, so the first time they put it up was the 4th of July, so women and families coming into town for the parade, for the events, you know, for whatever was going on in town, drive through the main street, and there's this disgusting material that they're forced to look at, and the kids, and of course, you know, people asking questions of what's all this. So there's been a great increase in the amount of all of that happening at the clinics. There's also been an increase in the number of pro-choice people coming out of the woodwork and speaking, and that's been really wonderful to have more people writing letters to the editor and just speaking up and being willing to talk about their own experiences, and that's been very helpful as well. We're all just holding our breath, waiting, wondering what's going to happen next. I'm very afraid for Dr. Carhart and for Dr. Hearn in particular, for some of the physicians that do the later term abortions. It boggles my mind that, again, these physicians, all of us, put our life on the line all the time, and now even more are feeling that pressure.
Sansara Taylor responding.
It is actually, it's a really sobering and unacceptable fact that the day after Dr. Tiller was killed, the anti-abortion fascists were at the clinics, like she's describing, some of them with big trucks with Dr. Tiller's face, saying heaven or hell, where'd he go, and posing the question of who's next, all of this. They were out there the next day, and there were not people defending the clinics out there. Look, there's the Christian fascist movement and what they're doing, and they are not just wing nuts from below, but they're very much been
positions of power.
In positions of power and given a lot of impetus by the power structure, given a lot of legitimacy, treated as it's outrageous. Randall Terry, who is he's a thug and a theocrat and a bigot, and he was given every major mainstream New York Times and everybody else ran his interviews. He's a head of Operation Rescue for years. He's harassed and targeted doctors and women, and they put him in there in every interview all over the country saying, oh, well, we wonder if, you know, we feel really bad about the murder, but he was a killer. And they let that run like that's legitimate. So all this on the one hand, but it's been conciliated to by the pro-choice movement that has been completely subordinated to the Democratic Party for the last 15 years or longer. And it's very crippling, and it's very damaging. I just want to say this. I want to take one example because it sets the context. Look, there are things we have to do right now on the ground that have to change about the safety of the doctors, but there's a whole framework that has to change. And for instance, in South Dakota, we were talking about this earlier, they had this, you know, a couple of years ago, people may remember, they passed a ban on abortion that was in all cases, even the life of the mother, rape or incest, any of this. And if you watched, and it was worth doing, and it was a little bit infuriating, or a lot infuriating, if you watched the pro-choice so-called ads countering this, they had one after the other saying, well, women should really have the right to abortion if they're raped. But some women who need abortions are impregnated through incest. And some women who need abortions will die if they don't get them. And all of those things are true. But you're just setting yourself up for what's come next. Okay, that bill got repealed, and the next thing they want to do is pass a ban on abortion except in cases of life of the mother, rape, and incest. And what have you done? You've accepted the framework that there's something wrong with abortion, and it's a whole dynamic that's been at play where yesterday's outrage is today's compromised position and tomorrow's limit of what we can even imagine being possible. And we actually have to get off that trajectory, and there's no way to get off of it except to get off of it and come out and say, well, abortion is a fundamental right, there's nothing wrong with it, women are human beings, and take that dark ages ish back in the dark ages. That's not how we want to live.
Yeah.
We talked about this earlier today, too. When we went to Dr. Tiller's funeral, it is an outrage. The organizations that are tied and subordinated to the Democratic Party, they did not send the leaders of these movements, these organizations, were not even at Tiller's funeral. They weren't even there. This is not going to come from anywhere but people who want this right, who are not going to capitulate and cow down to the realpolitik of now we have a Democrat in office, let's be more subdued and cooperative, but who are going to get out there and upset the political atmosphere and bring something into the terrain that's missing, which is that women are human beings, this is a fundamental right, there should be no apologies on it, and we're not relying on the state or the politicians to do this. Scott Roeder, the man who killed Dr. Tiller, was caught twice in the week leading up to the assassination, meddling with and damaging the property of another abortion clinic in Kansas. He was violating the Freedom to Access Clinic Entrances laws. It's a federal law. It's a federal violation. The clinic owners called in his license plate, his description, two times to the FBI, and they did nothing. They did nothing. This is why Dr. Tiller was killed. That's not what the state is there to do. The FBI has never been a friend of the people in this country or around the planet. It is not a friend to women. And it's really It's really going to be on us, and it's going to be on a whole new generation.
The next question asked was, how would overturning Roe v. Wade affect other progressive movements, such as gun control laws, labor rights, and anti-war efforts? Sansara Taylor responds.
Abortion is not some side issue. You know, no. I mean, I always find this absurd. Half of humanity, and it's like a special interest group side issue. Abortion it defines the role of, it sets terms for the role of half of humanity and affects all of humanity. And it's not just a side wedge issue. It's an issue that the movement to end abortion is not just about getting votes and inciting their base to get votes or attacking gay marriage to get votes in the election. It's really about ending women's participation in society as full human beings. It's really about enforcing motherhood. It's really about subjugating women. It's really about criminalizing gay marriage and shoring up the patriarchal, heterosexual, biblical marriage. And they really mean it. And they have a lot of power. And they're in the military, they're in the government, they're in high finance, they're in the media. And they're very serious, and people are very demobilized by this notion that it's just a side issue or that it should be ghettoized from the rest of what people are facing.
And now, Susan Wicklund.
I couldn't agree with you more, and that when we talk about abortion rights, reproductive rights, it is a human right. And when people try to say, and I have politicians say, it should be rare but legal, and it's anything but rare. You know, we know that somewhere between 30 and 40% of women in this country will have an abortion by the time they're age 45. 50 million women have had legal abortions since Roe v. Wade. 50 million women. And if you take that right away, if you take that opportunity away from women, it's going to have, as Sansara has been talking about, and as we all know, a huge impact on not only their reproductive lives, but their financial lives, their educational lives, and everything else. And of course, it does trickle down to affect every single person in their family, which is all of us.
The next question was, are media figures such as Bill O'Reilly responsible for Dr. Tiller's death? What about the freedom of speech argument? Susan Wicklund responds.
He was totally irresponsible. I also hold every single one of the protesters out in front of the clinics, hold those signs and say the things that they say. I hold every one of them responsible for the violence and for the violence that's continuing and for the murder of Dr. Tiller, because they are the ones that push the button of that one person who's crazy enough to actually pull the trigger. If there wasn't that kind of behavior and that kind of stuff on the television over and over and over again on something they call news, and if there wasn't the people out in front of the clinic supporting them and giving them places to live and feeding them information about the doctor's lives and where they go, there would not be this kind of violence directed towards the physicians. So for someone to be an anti-abortion activist all their life and to say the kinds of things that Bill O'Reilly has said over the years and then say, oh, we didn't really want someone to kill him, is just plain bullshit. Well, of course they wanted someone to kill him.
Sansara Taylor.
I mean, O'Reilly, if people don't know, did go on over and over again on the news and say, yeah, Tiller, the baby killer, this is a man who for $5,000 will help a woman murder her baby if she's depressed, blah-de-blah, just outright lies and all of this. One of the things, I think that this is where we get stuck a lot, too, and this is part of why I'm a communist and a revolutionary, is that if you look at things, we're always hamstrung by things like the freedom of speech. The First Amendment rights. I believe that people should have the freedom to air their ideas, and there should actually be a lot of ferment and exchange, and when we have state power, we would foster that. But in this society, that freedom sits on top of and obscures deeper fundamental relations of oppression and exploitation. Because we live in a society that is patriarchal, where the laws and the structures do reinforce the family unit, where men hold the, you know, dominant position and women are fundamentally mothers before anything else. They reinforce a society where black people are oppressed and systematically imprisoned or gunned down by the police, and it's always justifiable, and it doesn't happen that way to white kids in the same numbers. I mean, we live in a society that sits on the top of the planet. We're an imperialist empire, and the freedom of speech that people have in this country to the degree that they have it, and if you challenge the way things are, your freedom of speech is very the protesters against the war, rubber bullets. You know, it's very often curtailed, but you're always told we have a democracy, we have these freedoms, and it obscures deeper, more fundamental things. But until you get rid of those, it limits our thinking, even, in what we're striving for. And it's not that, look, in a socialist society, we would have freedom of speech. We would have the right to dissent. We'd actually foster it in a real way because we'd be about uprooting these things. But I feel this is a deeper issue than freedom of speech. It's about the role of half of humanity. And there really is a fault line on that about abortion, the murder of abortion doctors. It was never about freedom of speech for O'Reilly, for Randall Terry, for any of those people. It was about hatred of women and taking away the rights of women to be fully human.
Next question. Why are abortions performed in clinics? Wouldn't women be safer and have more privacy if abortions were done in hospitals instead? Dr. Wicklund responds.
First of all, when I started providing abortions and I went back to my hometown in Wisconsin, as I mentioned, the physician there who I took over for, he had been providing abortions there since the 40s in a very safe manner, in a very good facility, in the hospital, and calling it a DNC, as I mentioned. And patients were referred to him from all over the place. So there was a network of providers all over the country that did abortions, and many of them, again, were doctors who saw women dying in the wards before abortion was legal, and that's one of the reasons they were doing them in their own practices. When abortion became legal, and some groups started having clinics, etc., and as soon as the anti-abortion movement got involved, actually it was more mainstream for a while. There were many, many more physicians that did them in their own offices for a while when it first became legal. And then when I was in medical school in the 80s, so not that long after Roe v. Wade, the anti-abortion movement is a group called Life Dynamics out of Texas that has been very, very active in intimidating students from the time you begin in medical school. I remember getting a book of cartoons from Life Dynamics when I was a second year medical student. And these cartoons would show any doctor that did abortions as being marginalized, as being bad. They were laughed at by their colleagues, they were shamed, they were, you know, all these things. So there was this message, there was this group that was saying right from the beginning, you know, as we're progressing through medical school in very subtle and then very overt ways, if you do abortions, because this is a shameful, bad thing, we will expose you to your community, we'll make sure patients don't come to you, we will boycott you, we will do everything we can to hurt your practice. There are many physicians that were doing abortions in North Dakota when I first started going up, not many, there were a handful of doctors doing abortions, but the anti-abortion people would go to them and say, we will harass your children, we will follow your wife to the hairdresser, we will go to your grocery store and picket, we will do anything we can to make you stop doing abortions. So there's been a very active, aggressive movement aimed towards medical or towards physicians. So that's one reason why it's become really marginalized, and many other physicians who they say they are pro-choice, but they don't want to do the abortions themselves, and they don't want someone in their practice doing abortions because they're afraid it'll hurt their bottom line. Money is more important to them than actually caring for that other group of patients, which is, you know, all the women, basically. And then there's something else that I think is important, you mentioned now about, you know, why aren't they done in every hospital in the operating room. Actually, abortion is, in the first trimester, is a very, very simple procedure. And I really feel like it shouldn't be done in hospitals, because you go into a hospital and there are all the infections and all the bacteria, and it costs a fortune to go into the hospital. There are many reasons I feel it still is important to keep at least first trimester abortions in a clinic setting. However, it could be done much different than it is now and not marginalize us, you know, and put us at risk as much as it does. But an abortion procedure takes 4 or 5 minutes. For the last 18 years, I've been doing abortions for over 20 years. For the last 18 years, I have used only a local anesthetic, a small injection in the cervix when I do an abortion on a woman. Most of my patients talk through it. They get up and walk. As soon as we're done, they're fine. They get off the table. They go into the recovery room. They sit for half an hour. They have something to eat and drink. They leave the clinic smiling. They leave the clinic not cramping, not bleeding heavily. It's a very simple procedure. It's the simplest and the most common minor procedure we do in the United States today. The simplest and the most common minor procedure we do in the United States today. It takes about 5 minutes. It is not a horrible, awful, grueling, bloody, disgusting procedure. It is a very simple procedure. And I think the more people understand that, there really isn't a need for a woman to spend $5,000 and go into a hospital and have a DNC to do an abortion. But it could be done in a very different way. The physicians could be doing them in their own clinics. They could be doing them in the exam room. You know, when you see, you have a prenatal visit for one patient, you have somebody with the flu that you're seeing, you have somebody else that you're checking on. This is a family practice doc, let's say. Somebody else you're checking on to see how that arm has set when you set the cast last week, or the orthopedes referred them back for a checkup. And then in the next room, you see a woman for an abortion. It should be that mainstreamed, in my opinion.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Our program today is a broadcast of a presentation on abortion, morality, and the liberation of women, featuring Dr. Susan Wicklund, the author of This Common Secret, My Journey as an Abortion Provider, and Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revolution Newspaper. The next question is, what are your views on late-term abortions? Dr. Wicklund responds.
First of all, somewhere around 95% or 96% of all abortions are done in the first trimester, so the huge majority are. None of us know what the circumstances are for any woman who in her fourth or fifth month decides to end a pregnancy. Does she have a Down syndrome she can't deal with? Does she have an anencephalic fetus? Does she have something that's not going to be able to survive after birth? Does she have cancer of the breast and need to have an abortion so that she can get chemotherapy to be alive for her children? Or is she just not willing and ready to be a mother right then and for whatever reason has found herself at that advanced stage? And so, you know, we are not in a position where we should be judging anybody and why they choose to have an abortion at whatever stage they do. It is not a real common thing to have women in that stage. But I will always refer a woman at whatever stage of pregnancy she is, to somebody who can help her if I cannot. And I am not willing to decide for her. None of us should be ever able to. The government shouldn't be able to. Another physician shouldn't be able to. Only the person who can decide whether or not that pregnancy is going to go full term is the woman and her own physician.
And now Sansara Taylor.
Part of the thing about late-term abortion is that it's one of these areas that is very, very, very rare when you consider abortion overall, but it's made a very big deal out of by the anti-abortion movement, and it's used to confuse and muddle people a lot. And I think, you know, we have to come back to the fact that until a fetus is, you know, as long as it's a fetus, it really is a subordinate part of a woman's body. It's not an independent biological being or independent social being. It's part of a woman's body. Increasingly, women are getting later term abortions because it's increasingly difficult to find them early. Mm-hmm. And that the onus for that is on the movement to end abortion. It's, you know, having to go through waiting periods, having to travel across state lines, having to get a mandatory, you know, approval of your parents, having to go to fake clinics and get the runaround. All these things are what millions of women face every day right now. And this is why, you know, and it's true, women they discover their pregnancy later, they don't know how to protect themselves. All of this is at the fault and at the foot of the Christian fascist anti-abortion movement. They are responsible for this. And then when they create conditions that force women to wait later and later to get abortions and have a harder and harder time, and then they demonize women for being stuck in that position, we cannot accept that framework in those terms. And this is, the whole thing is illegitimate. I just have to say, you know, and her thing, you don't know what each woman is going through. But the greater context of why are we putting on a procedure that's so rare, late-term abortion, and for the most women who do it, it is late enough in their pregnancy that they decided they wanted a child, and there's either a health complication of their own lives or the fetus is not developing well.
And the last question, what kind of violence do abortion providers deal with in their daily lives? Sansara Taylor speaks to the question first.
I really think if people had any idea, pro-choice people, people who take the right to abortion for granted, had any idea what the doctors who provide these services actually go through, they would really have reason to rethink their own responsibility to this right and to the providers. And I think this is the other part of what we have to share that we heard tonight. I remember at Dr. Tiller's funeral, somebody told this story of Dr. Tiller after he was shot in both arms in the 90s. A friend of his lost his job, and Dr. Tiller was commiserating with him and comforting him and calling him every day for over a week. And finally, you know, the friend was speaking and he said, you know, he never talked about himself the whole time. And then one morning he just said, listen, man, you lost your job. I lost my freedom.
And now, Dr. Susan Wicklund.
Well, I'll talk about it some, but I'm also not going to talk about it enough to put myself at more risk. Definitely the security has... the consciousness has stepped up. I'm much more aware of, as I always have been, but I will admit there was a time, when, you know, for a number of years where it kind of decreased a bit. But every time you turn this key on in the car, you wonder if it's going to blow up. Every time I walk out of the house, I wonder if there's somebody on the far hill watching me with the binoculars. Every time I come into the back of the clinic, I wonder if there's somebody up in the apartment buildings above watching down at the entrance and when I get out of the car, what I'm doing. So there's a conscious awareness, except when I go to the mountains. And that's why I live in the mountains, so I can find a place to escape, because it is scary.
All right, that wraps up this week's show. I really want to thank the people who pointed me in the right direction to get this video, this audio from the film that was made of this presentation, Abortion, Morality, and the Liberation of Women. And you can find the video if you go to the World Can't Wait website, that's worldcantwait.org, or if you go to YouTube and search for World Can't Wait videos, you'll find it up in there. It's Abortion, Morality, and the Liberation of Women. And I'd really like to thank those folks who pointed me in the right direction to get the audio from this presentation. And this presentation is actually available as a video, as a DVD. You can either get it from Revolution Books in New York City, and you'll have to Google that and find the contact info, or you can go to YouTube and search for World Can't Wait videos, and you'll find this video there. It's called Abortion, Morality, and the Liberation of Women. Get this, show it to your friends, to your family, set up showings in your neighborhoods, in your towns, in your schools, whatever. Get the word out. It's really that important. And I want to thank Dr. Susan Wicklund and Sansara Taylor for actually making the presentation in the first place. You know, it's very interesting. You know, it's really, really interesting when you think about all the stuff that's out there and how much we have to fight to get these kind of voices heard, but how important it is that they are heard. And along those lines, I want to point out that everyone, I really recommend that everyone pick up Dr. Susan Wicklund's book, This Common Secret, My Journey as an Abortion Provider. I'd also like to recommend that people check out Sansara Taylor's work on Revolution Newspaper's website, and that site is revcom.us. And you can also go to her blog, which is sansara.blogspot.com. And for those of you who are in various parts of the country, Sansara Taylor will also be making a speaking tour in the coming weeks and months. And the title of the speech is From the Burqa to the Thong, Everything Must and Can Change. We Need Total Revolution. Sansara will be speaking at NYU on February 23rd in New York City, at the University of Chicago on March 3rd, and she'll be at UCLA and UC Berkeley later in April. And one more recommendation. Visit the revcom.us website and look for a piece called A Declaration for Women's Liberation and the Emancipation of All Humanity. Really a tremendous declaration around the oppression of women and the liberation of women put out by the Revolutionary Communist Party, USA. I'd also recommend that people at that same website, people check out Bob Avakian's latest work on Unresolved Contradictions, Driving Forces for Revolution. There's a whole section of that is concentrated up on the oppression of women and what it's going to take to get out from under that, to end it. In going out, now I want to take a minute and read something from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on this question. In many ways, particularly for men, the oppression of women, and whether you seek to completely abolish or to preserve the existing property and social relations and the corresponding ideology that enslave women, or maybe just a little bit of them, is a touchstone question among the oppressed themselves. It is a dividing line between wanting in and really wanting out, between fighting to end all oppression and exploitation and the very division of society into classes, and seeking in the final analysis to get your part in this. If we've learned anything from today's show and from all the shows we've done, is that the world does indeed cry out for radical revolutionary change. But the kind of world we get depends on what we do or don't do. So it's up to you. I'm Michael Slate, and you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Marlena Shaw's cover of Nina Simone's I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free.
Just to break all of the chains that kinda keep binding.